Morning. So my topic today, I'm looking at incarnation and hope in the light of it being Advent and a time of waiting. So my, you know, not ambitious at all brief is, who was Jesus and what difference does it make? So as we enter into that, just be present this morning to what the longings of your heart are. What are you hoping for? This is a season of hoping and waiting. What is it that you long for? And carry that as we think and talk about God, Jesus, the possibility of hope, that the thing you long for is part of this, not in an abstract sense. So incarnation is a word that means in flesh incarne. It's the concept of God existing in a human body, or a human body being the physical presence of God. And Christian tradition from very early on proclaimed that Jesus was absolutely God and absolutely human. And for centuries, they tested out ways to make sense of that. And for lots of groups would get hold of an idea, and this is how you can explain how that might work. And they almost always had a piece of the truth, and the further they ran with it, the further it came clear that actually that piece on its own wasn't going to work, and that's when they'd get called heretics. So there was this centuries of working on, what does this mean? And in 451 in Chalcedon, they wrote a definition that affirmed that Jesus was both God and human, and fully acknowledged the inherent paradox that they had no way of solving, that out of their 450 years of wrestling with this paradox, their experience said this was true, and their experience said trying to smooth it over doesn't work. Can we still believe this as modern post-enlightenment people with science and an understanding of metaphysics and comparative religion and studies in mythology? We have a globalized consciousness. Our world is a lot bigger than the worlds of the people who wrote this stuff. And we have a recognition of the politics and power plays that went into early church doctrine, along with their genuine experience of a God. John Hick says that the traditional understandings of the incarnation ask people to believe something which one cannot spell out at all in intelligible terms, which he says it's not right to expect of people. He says this is not a divine mystery, but one that was created by a group of human beings meeting at Chalcedon in present-day Turkey in the mid-5th century. So he does away entirely with the notion of Jesus being God. In his context, he's amongst Muslims in Iran, and the incarnation's the key sticking point in dialogue. And when he finds he can't hold on to it, he dialogues without it. So that's one option, is to say, well, we just can't hold that anymore. It wasn't true and it's not true. It's not an option that sits well with me. A second way in, which is what I've kind of vaguely held for some time, a way to hold on to the truth of the humanity and the divinity without a metaphysical impossibility, is an idea that Jesus somehow, by being the fullest possible human, was divine, that the definition of full humanity is divinity. So every human in this way of looking at things carries the invitation and the potential to respond fully, so fully to God, that our will and God's will become one. And we act with complete self-emptying love. And in that self-emptying, we manifest God. So to be fully human is to be divine, in loving communion poured out. And humanity is evolving in that direction, is the language that gets used. So Jesus was the fully evolved human, the self-given for others. To know God then is not to grasp at God, but to be so self-emptying that we are open to being grasped by God, taken up into the love and the very life of work of God. And this divine human potential is the invitation of grace that we each respond to only by the empowering of the Spirit. Seventh century Byzantine theologian Maximus the Confessor, that's a great name to put on your census form. He taught this as, he called it deification or divinization, where we are drawn into the divine dance of relationship of the persons of the Trinity. And that concept is still important in Eastern Orthodox theology, that this deification notion. Protestant theology would more likely call that sanctification, but it's in the same school. Teilhard de Chardin, who is a 20th century Jesuit priest and paleontologist who was exiled by the Vatican to China for a long time. He sort of was exiled there, and then there was the Second World War and he couldn't get out to the deserts of China. He speaks about all atoms in the universe moving towards union, that the union of atoms creates more union, is more creation. And so the ultimate unity is the incarnate Christ. So Jesus then is the example of how we are to be divine humans. And Jesus also becomes the link between God and humans in our current form, the point at which heaven and earth meet, and through which we then are able to move through into being the divine humans. Ultimately, Jesus differs from us in degree rather than in nature. Jesus is more of rather than totally different. And it really challenges the divine-human dualism and polarity. I really like the way this reworks incarnation language in terms that makes sense in the 21st century. I like that it acknowledges the divine spark within each of us, the place where deep speaks to deep and turns us towards God. I appreciate the potential for the language of fully God, fully human to be held on to, and that this has in it an inherent call to a life of service for others, because the expression of fullness of humanity is outpouring for others. So as I've been reading over the last couple of weeks, I thought I was going to talk today about explaining this notion to you and clarifying it. The more I read, the more it just didn't sit right. So I put it out there because it may be something that's useful for where you're at, for what's important for you. But for me, I found as I read into this notion that I felt it was diminishing who God is. I was concerned about what felt like a kind of human arrogance to say, we're pretty close to God, actually. We just need a bit of tweaking. Which doesn't really take seriously the struggle that I have to love even the people who live in my house, let alone the whole of creation. It hasn't been a good week for some of those smaller people in my house. Mea culpa. The self-emptying love is not a tweak on the human condition. It is a radical transformation. This notion of being fully human, being to be divine, has a sense of that the evolution is from human to superhuman. Whereas most human tradition actually talks about that shift being more like from amoeba to human, which takes more than a tweak. I also think it diminishes the value of our humanness, because humanness becomes a state to get out of. The problem for ancient Christians was that they encountered someone who they felt was more than a human somehow. And their early writings are trying to explain how this not quite human person was actually human. The point is for them how to hang on to the humanity of Jesus. The problem for us is how to hang on to the divinity of Jesus. Because we're very comfortable with believing in a historical figure, Jesus of Nazareth. Which makes me wonder if the issue is not about incarnation at all, but that we're simply no longer comfortable with any notion of miraculous divine intervention. The divine in reaching to humanity, the potential for supernatural occurrence. if we have a preconceived notion that God cannot reach into human life, then we're not open to the possibilities of playing with what God may have done to reach into human life. Whether that's incarnation or resurrection or miraculous healing or wine at wedding feasts. And I readily acknowledge there is plenty of evidence of where God has not reached into human experience. I'm very Nick Cave about the interventionist God most of the time. But I also have to acknowledge that for 2,000 years, tens of thousands of people have claimed to experience God's inreaching, and that that includes some of the earliest followers of Jesus. I believe something happened in Jesus that doesn't fit our intellectual categories, and I think we are diminished if we try to logic it away. In the amoeba image, God is as different from us as we are from an amoeba and enters our reality, which is as unlikely as a human being becoming an amoeba, and in so doing transforms us. Jesus somehow is both completely of our amoeba reality and completely God's pre-existent eternal reality. And that doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. At least it doesn't make human sense. And that's the only mind we've got. Who is this Jesus to you? Just pause as we, this is a lot of words this morning, pause whether Jesus is a historical figure for you, whether Jesus is here with us this morning for you, or both. Allow the longings that are in your heart to be present in the same space as Jesus, the Jesus you do know or the Jesus you would like to know. I can't prove the incarnation, but in my gut it feels right. So my reading has become this week testing around to see if it was intellectually plausible. Not provable, but plausible. So I'm going to offer you some reasons I think it might be plausible. I have to say up front that my understanding of Bible texts is that they reflect the life of early Christian communities. And just like our Christian communities, that is not a perfect reflection of God. Just because they say so doesn't mean that it is exactly what happened. But it was their genuine experience. They were genuinely trying to respond to Jesus, to respond to the presence of God among them. And we cannot just dismiss that either. Especially if we believe in a God who could potentially inreach, a God who may have been actively involved in their life together as they were forming these texts and ideas. Now, I've been asked sometimes if I'm going to talk about something complicated to put notes on the board, so I'm roughly about to follow the left-hand column if that's useful for you. If it's not useful, just don't look at it. I hope my handwriting's not my greatest strength. So just don't put it in front of the speaker, teacher. The first thing is the way Jesus thought about himself. Now, we obviously can't get inside Jesus' head. And Jesus never explicitly said, "I am God." But he lived as if it was true. Edward Schillebeek says, Jesus' problem was not an identity for him, it was only a problem for his followers. Probably because Jesus was so busy just doing it, being God, being poured out in unconditional love, he didn't have time or energy to reflect metaphorically on his existence. N.T. Wright says he probably never sat down around the campfire and said, "I'm the second person of the Trinity." But he profoundly believed it was his vocational calling to do and be what he did and was. And the things he did within his Jewish worldview, only God should have been doing. The most dramatic was that without any temple ritual or appropriate role, he forgave sins in his own name. He just forgave them. He called God Abba, an unprecedented level of intimacy. I note there are some scholars who think other people were using Abba, and others argue that no, it's all after Jesus. But it's a radical intimacy to use Abba. He spoke with authority. There's never any, the Lord said to me, or thus says the Lord, I say. The word of God never came to Jesus. He just had it, or maybe he just was it. And he claimed that a relationship with him would determine our status with God, that he, Jesus, would judge at the end of history. The sheep and the goats parable, for example. Whenever you did it for the least of these, you did it for me, not for God, for me. Now, why would a wandering Aramaean prophet of Galilee say, you need to do help the poor for me? And at the end of that parable, and I will judge, the Son of Man, which is clearly a term he uses for himself, will judge. So possibly, I think it's intellectually plausible that Jesus could have seen himself as able to be God, even if he never articulated it consciously to himself. First century Judaism was strictly monotheistic. One God, one God, one God. It's a base tenet of Jewish thought. And so many people have said it would be impossible for a Jew to consider that they could be God, that anyone could be God except God. But, and I'm leaning on N.T. Wright here because he's not the only voice here, and many would say something else. The Jewish thought had a concept of Yahweh who did personal presence. He had been personally present to them in their Old Testament, their Hebrew scriptures. They understood that he could be, God could be present. So it's not so outrageous, I don't think, that Jesus could be seen as the embodied presence of a God who does presence in that sense. The Jews had a strong sense of the temple being a place where God literally dwelt in a special and active way. And Jesus describes himself and people describe him in ways that are talking like a new temple. The text from John, the word became flesh and dwelt among us. The word dwelt is to set up his tent. And it's not just any tent, it's a tabernacle. The word became flesh and tabernacled amongst us, the sacred tent of the people in the desert. I believe it's talking about this idea of the presence of God that could be in a temple, could be in a tabernacle, could be in this person. There was lots of opposition to the Christians from the early Jewish establishment, and they were condemned because they were accused of abandoning monotheism. Now, nobody would bother to make that accusation if they weren't saying godlike things about Jesus. The gospel stories imply that that religious opposition happened during his life because people were outraged at the things he was doing that were giving the impression that he thought himself equal to God. Acknowledging that the early Christian communities could have backwrit those bits to reflect their own time of persecution. The resurrection and the ascension. The early church disagreed about a lot of things, but they were united in believing that these things physically actually happened. Now, that doesn't prove that Jesus is God, but it does mean you've got to reconsider his death, not as a failure, but as some sort of victory. And that led the early Christians to rethink Jesus' teachings in ways that seemed to show that his life, death, life, was some sort of victory, some sort of achievement that fulfilled things between humans and God. And that very easily leads to a sense that if Jesus' life, death, life fulfills things between humans and God, Jesus perhaps is not just a human, but the presence of God. The post-Easter response of the early church suggests they had encountered something more than human. Now, this is a community of staunch monotheists encountering something that felt like God to them. And their response is remarkable for the things they said about Jesus, the way they lived their life in response. Again, it's not proof that he was God, but it adds weight in the light of other factors. And it's linked to the coming of the Holy Spirit. The early Christians responded to both a communal and an individual sense of God's presence among them in a new way. And they identified both that presence among them and the historical Jesus as God. And if they were all wrong, many, many of them went to their deaths for it. I don't know what I would go to my death for, but I doubt it would be the theology of the incarnation. Paul's writings hold open the potential that he thought Jesus was God. There seems to be an assumption in his work that Christ was somehow personally pre-existent, was an agent in creation. So we read this morning hymns from Colossians and Philippians. Both of those are sections believed to be earlier than Paul, that Paul has incorporated into his writing. So we're talking about expressions of Christian faith from possibly only 10, at the most 20 years after the life, death, life of Jesus. Very early expressions that have a sense of God, somehow Christ pre-existing, being in creation and being in Jesus. Paul's churches that he's writing to, it clearly wasn't an issue for them, so he never bothers to defend it. He just slips it in as a background assumption. Now, you might have noticed my language just shifted from Jesus to Christ, if you're very astute. The word Christ is the Greek word for Jewish word Messiah, and it brings in all this post-resurrection implications, but it's deeply tied to the historical Jesus as well. It's intertwined. You cannot separate Christ from the historical Jesus in the way that Paul writes of Christ. There's bits of Paul where he makes completely irrelevant assertions if you're talking about a human being, like born of a woman. There's absolutely no need to say someone is born of a woman unless someone is thinking they might not be. And the only reason you would be thinking they might not be is because you think they might be someone divine. That's from Galatians. Galatians is one of the earliest books of Paul we've got. There are the texts, Philippians is a classic, but it's not just in Philippians, about the emptying, that a pre-existent nature somehow is set aside for a time to enable human form. And I readily acknowledge that is not the only way to read those texts. Possibly the thing for me that's the most important is that what we even mean by God is determined by Jesus. If we start this whole discussion with a Western Enlightenment understanding of what God means, or with a Greco-Roman God, or with a Jewish God even, or any God that we've picked up on our travels and come to it with, we might not see God. And we probably won't see God in Jesus. But if we start with Jesus, even just, inverted commas, just Jesus, the wisdom teacher, if we start there, we find God in new and transformative ways. And these are ways that I think open up the potential for incarnation to be real. And that's a lot to give you. I feel like I've whacked you over the head. Draw your attention back to Jesus, however you understand Jesus. Be present to that focus, and wherever that focus on Jesus leads you this morning, it might not lead you to the same endpoint that I end up. Just Focus on where Jesus is leading you. I'm now going to attempt the other side of the board. I believe in incarnation because it is such a rich source of hope. And I think that's what I've discovered in my reading in the last 2 weeks, was that where I came into the reading with, the more I picked at it, the less hope it had. And the more I read about the traditional understanding, the more hope it gave me. And I'm not good at hope. I've said this from up here before. Hope is one of my challenges. The reason I love Advent is because it feels like the Church Universal takes 4 weeks to go, gee, it's really hard to hope. Let's all hope. Just a few weeks of the year, it feels like I'm in resonance with the Christian thing. Why is an incarnation, a fully God, fully human being in Jesus, hope for me? Jesus becomes God as a lowly one, and this is unbelievable. Evil is transformed from within. Weakness becomes the means of transformation, and suffering moves beyond itself into life. Jesus is a very good human, or God pretending to be a human. Don't open this possibility, because God remains the big mighty one in either of those understandings. It's really common in Christianity and in many world religions to have a lofty God. And the merciful God, when God is big, is the God who reaches down to an underling. But the incarnate God gets below human beings and lifts us up. The incarnate God reveals that the self-giving is the core of God. It's what it means to be God. The transformative power of God is the self-giving, not the strength and might. So the incarnation redefines God. Jesus is not the average of all human beings, but one particular human being. Theologians call this the scandal of particularity. And so are we. We are none of us the average of human beings. We are scandalously particular. And we are called to love our scandalously particular neighbours. God was once one of them. Perhaps God dwells in each of them in their particular neighbourly ways. And because in Jesus, God was scandalously tied to one time, one person, and one place, God is able to be present to us in our scandalous particularity of time and place and person. If your head is now completely overflowing and you want to stop, just sit with, in the particular of your life, the details of your time, your place, your person, God is with you. However low you feel, God has gone lower for you. The understanding of Jesus as the divine person who understands human struggles has been pivotal for the faith of marginalised communities. Black theology in particular holds this as very central, and black women in particular have a very strong culture of praying to the suffering companion Jesus. They pray because he's God. They feel understood because he's human, and because he's a marginalised and persecuted human. He's not just an example, but an enabling presence. Wendy Farley says Jesus' humanity makes him a soul friend, his divinity pierces the suffering with beauty. And we white intellectuals must not dismiss this. This is core to people who are not us, as the thing that has given hope to marginalise people for a long time. The presence of Jesus, and especially the suffering Jesus, has been really significant for mystics for centuries. The people who go deep into a life of prayer frequently encounter a human Jesus divinely present. And in their own emptying, they find the incarnate God drawing them into God's self, being wrapped in God so that their will aligns with God and they know themselves as utterly beloved. Julian of Norwich, medieval mystic, says, "Our souls are made of God, and in that point we are knit to God. Christ is the ground in whom our soul stands." It's not a loss of self. This self-emptying is a homecoming into the beloved true self. So the incarnation opens up for us ways of prayer where we know ourselves as God's beloved. Whatever the atonement theory you hold to, atonement being how things are made right between God and people, whether you have a sense that Jesus paid a penalty for sin to reconnect us, or that somehow Jesus' death crushes evil, defeats death, or transforms humans in a new way for living, or a mix of all of the above, or you've never really thought it through, an incarnate being, God and human, underpins all of those. For any of those ways of understanding in atonement, I'll use the technical word, for any of them to be effective, God must be both human and divine. Because of the incarnation, somehow, things between humans and God are fulfilled in a way that would not be possible with either an only human or an only God agent. I like Vernon White and Paul Fides have this concept that through the incarnation, God equips God's self with an experience that is then universally applicable through the work of the Spirit. They talk about it being like a mountain guide who must first walk the tricky pass before they can be fully equipped to take others with them who would follow. That God, by coming into the life-death life of being a human, can therefore take us over the tricky path of life and death and life. And even if God didn't require an incarnation for this to work, we did. We need something to hold on to. So God translates God's self into human so that we can know God. We don't live or love in response to abstractions or ideas. We love in relationship. We love beings. God shows. God doesn't tell. Kathleen Norris says, "Mary did not produce a treatise, but a baby." This is not commandments, but revelation. Helmut Thielicke says, "God has become human, and now I am no longer alone in the darkness." God is Emmanuel. God is with us. We are not alone in the darkness. This is not just an idea or a presence, but one point in time and space, through actually being human and being amongst us, that God is with us. God loves and renews us as humans, not ideas or concepts or theories. And so the material world is transformed. Karl Rahner says, "It must be worthwhile being a human being if God was not satisfied to be in God's self, but also willed, in addition, to be one of these human beings. If God values bodies enough to become one, then our bodies are okay. And there are moral responsibilities for how we treat our bodies and the bodies of other. Nothing anymore is only human, because we are also always sacred. And every human face becomes an expression of God's presence, which has ethical implications and is also a source of hope, because every human face has the potential of God alive in them, working transformation, which is what our world needs." Miles Connolly talks about being saved from the infinitude. He says, we are not just bacteria breeding on a pebble in space. Isn't that a lovely image? But individuals who matter to God. Karl Rahner talks about us being not a herd, but a family in which God is a member. And if God is not just observing us, but in our family, God's family, then it must end well. Paul Fides again says, incarnation is not to be comprehended, but participated in. It draws us into the intimate love relationship between God the Mother Father and God the Son human. So we don't just think about God as Mother Father, we call to God as Abba, Amma. We are entered into and invited into the community of God, which joys in expanding to include us. Helmut Thielicke says, belief in incarnation is a risk, because what if it all turns out to be a fairy tale? And it's true. It's a risk. Through my reading, particularly this week, I've come to think, what is the risk of not affirming the incarnation? Who do I lose? Who is my God? And who am I? And where is my hope? And these are not rhetorical questions, because I know for some of you today, the leap to affirm incarnation is a leap too far. And that doesn't mean you've abandoned God. You really need to know that. If this is a leap too far, you have not abandoned God. But you've opened up a space for wrestling with who the God is that you are following. My conviction that I am beloved of God, that each of you are beloved of God, rests really deeply on the incomprehensible event of God somehow being fully present in the human Jesus. This is not the only way to understand what happened with Jesus, but it is the one that gives me hope. Do you want to just sit while your heads explode, or would you like to ask questions?
The idea of Jesus being the Christ, and in fact Christ is the, as I understand it, perhaps the God part and Jesus is the human part. Can you talk about that a little bit?
So the Christ, the Messiah, could have been a just human. There's a place within the tradition at the time that they could call Jesus Christ without it meaning that he was God. But it's used in early Christian writings to express for them the sense that there was more going on than just a human being, a very good one who was somehow, you know, extremely connected. So it takes on a new meaning when it's used in Christian language to what it had before that, is my understanding. And part of that new meaning, the way it's used, particularly in Paul, has this pre-existent creation sense to it.
Just trying to remember that bit that you said about at the end about we have something about taking the risk of believing in an incarnate God. And it struck me that God takes a risk also, because as sure as the hot cross buns are going to be in the shops in a couple of weeks, us humans are going to decide the best thing we can do is kill him.
Thank you. Down here, John's. The microphone is so the people listening at home can hear the questions.
Yes, I'd like to pick up a very significant sentence you uttered at the end there, that incarnation is not to be comprehended, but to be participated in. I'm a graduate of a very famous university in physics, and I'm a comprehender, and I'm a fixer. And I have had to learn that the desire to comprehend something, the incarnation is an example, but other facets of Jesus, is really a continuation of Adam's rebellion against God, of wanting to be master of my own fate. Yeah. I want to thank you for what you had to say.
And that's, I think, the challenge then for many of us heading into this season, when we hear the language of this message over and over. How are we participating in the incarnation through Christmas this year?
Dad learning from his daughter.
The reason I'm all teary is because I keep looking over there, it's my mum and dad.
Claire, in your reading, did you find the linkage that I would have seen between the incarnation, God getting in the flesh form, and starting from the flesh, the evidence, back to the theory as the basis of our modern society and science? In other words, without the incarnation thinking, we couldn't have what we would call modern science today, which takes evidence, gets a theory, adjusts the theory when more evidence goes in another direction, because the creation, God said it was good, and we've got the incarnation to endorse that in Jesus. Now, how the linkage there is between how we live today as a modern society based on science and our incarnation teaching.
I think the ripples are very wide. But I also recognise that there was some phenomenal science came out of Arab cultures and came out of China where they didn't know this explicitly. So it's both, I think.
Thanks, Claire. You always get me really thinking.
Yes!
Okay, now human beings, the way I see it, here's my theory anyway. Human beings are a combination of the physical body and the spirit, and spirit means breath, life. It's effectively the essence of who a person is, so that when they die, only the physical body is left, so they're not the person anymore. God doesn't have a body, a physical component. God is purely spirit, an infinite spirit. So for me, somehow Jesus managed to combine the body of the human, which includes all the connections with the spirit, like the mind and the soul and whatever, but his spirit was the spirit of God. And that's what we would aspire to with Jesus' assistance and gifting of the Holy Spirit. But for me, that's okay, that's how I explain how Jesus is God and human.
One of the Greek schools of the time that the New Testament was written was Gnosticism, which had this idea that your spirit was the really good thing and your body was the yucky shell that you just couldn't wait to get rid of. And quite a lot of our New Testament is written in relation to that, sometimes trying to particularly oppose that, to say, no, our bodies are important because we love and serve each other in bodies, that it's not okay to say, never mind about your body, it's just about spirit. But there is some of that sense of the God. It's the thing we can't express. And you know, if that's the expression for you that works, then wonderful. Yeah. Jenny's going to round me up.
I've got a quibble.
Nah.
Yeah.
Quibble with Claire?
I would say that Jesus did say that he was God, and he said it repeatedly. He said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. He said, the Father and I are one. There's no doubt he was talking about God. Yeah. And most spectacularly, talking to a bunch of Jews, he said, I tell you the truth. Before Abraham was, I am. Yeah.
The reason I don't claim that as Jesus saying so is because it's from the Gospel of John, which is written considerably later. And if we base our theology of who Jesus is on the claims written in John alone, we're in trouble, because it's several generations after. It's an outworking of a long experience of God and wrestling with what it could mean. So I think that out of whatever it is, it's about three generations of working with the experience of Jesus. They look back at what he said, and they, even if he never said those words, they go, "We really think this is what he meant. We'll say it." But I'm not convinced. And the scholars who do the historical Jesus stuff, they won't allow any of those statements in John to be the actual words of Jesus of Nazareth recorded. So it's a leap of faith, which, great if we, I mean, I'm doing that leap of faith, but it's a leap of faith to say the words recorded in John were actually the words of Jesus because of the historical gap between the writing and the experience. But, yeah.